Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Vince Masson.
And we were just, like, brainstorming a Die Hard remake starring Adam Sandler as John McClane on Netflix.
Yeah. It spiraled out of control into that, is what we should say.
The only caveat I will add is that David Spade has to play Hans Gruber, because that feels like the only way this can go.
Right, yeah. I second that.
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
So we're going to stick to doing our radio show since we're clearly poor movie developers.
Should Rob Schneider be involved somehow?
He can play... No, you're right, he can play Carl. He can play the main henchman.
Okay, cool.
End Credits is your local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. for the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new comedy-ish drama, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items. We're going to talk about the films that will be that have just been announced that are going to be part of the Sundance Film Festival in January. Or is that February? Well, whenever that is. We're not going, but we're going to wish we were, because we're going to talk about some of the movies there. And then we're going to review the newest Avengers trailer, talk about whether or not this is the end of the Marvel Universe as we know it. But first, we wanted to talk about another cinematic universe that didn't happen. Guillermo del Toro, who is kind of basking in the glow and anticipation for his new movie, The Shape of Water, which... I think could be described as Creature from the Black Lagoon, a love story. I don't know if that trailer, you guys saw that trailer before, mm-hmm. Three Billboards? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it should come as no surprise that Del Toro's biggest regret, and, you know, you wouldn't think he'd have, well, maybe he would have a lot of regrets, because I was kind of going over the laundry list of things he turned down. But he basically regrets not signing on to the Dark Universe. He was basically offered the Dark Universe. This was like the planned shared universe of The Mummy and Frankenstein and Jekyll and Hyde and Dracula and all those guys that was supposed to start earlier this year, and it didn't happen because they bungled the job with The Mummy. But yeah, this is Del Toro's biggest regret, and you know, he was supposed to direct the Hobbit movies at one point. He was working with Peter Jackson to direct the Hobbit movies, and then I think it was MGM hit the proverbial skids. And he moved on to other things. But yeah, you know what? And he regrets not doing the Mummy and the Frankenstein and all that. And I kind of regret it too, because I think that was actually something that could have been special, could have been unique in all this sort of shared universe madness. And they kind of wasted it on a Tom Cruise movie. I think you reviewed The Mummy with me, Vince.
Yes. Yeah, I keep trying to forget it, and then you just keep bringing it back up again. You keep resurrecting it, actually.
Ooh,
no
yes.
Pun intended.
No, yes.
Yeah, and Guillermo del Toro just had like an exhibit, some sort of exhibit in Toronto as well.
I think it's on until January.
It's still going on, yes.
Yeah.
And if you like browse through that, you see how much of an influence those Universal monsters actually had on him. So it seems very strange that it didn't happen.
It's at the Art Gallery of Ontario, by the way.
Right, AGO, yeah.
And I'm just looking it up because I think it is still on. But continue. I will interject.
That was my point, end point.
Yeah. Tim.
We're all remiss because of that.
But he's inspired by so many films. Like, I saw him talk at TIFF Bell Lightbox probably like 5 years ago, and he was introducing a Hitchcock movie, Shadow of a Doubt, which I had never seen, and it was such a great movie. And he showed his deep appreciation of Hitchcock. He's written books on Hitchcock. So I think he has a wide gamut of filmmaking knowledge that I don't know if he necessarily has to just do monster movies all the time, you know? Like,
but I think that's his his passion.
Wheelhouse.
His wheelhouse. Yeah, that's his passion. You know, if you look at his record, you know, Pan's Labyrinth, Monsters, Hellboy, Monsters, Kronos, Monsters.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he did Crimson Peak, which is Ghost Story. But, you know, but one of his passion projects was... In the Mouth of Madness, the Lovecraft novel, which could never get off the ground, mm-hmm. even though if there's like such a clear adaptation of or clear correlation between filmmaker and source material, I can't think of anyone more qualified or better qualified to make In the Mouth of Madness. But yeah, it is where his passion lies. And for the record, Guillermo del Toro at home with monsters at the AGO is in its final weeks. It closes on January 7th, 2018. So you can go to AGO.ca and get your tickets now. Mm-hmm. Wonderfully creepy, says Post City. I have never heard of that publication, but we'll accept their endorsement.
Yeah.
Can we at least admit that the Mummy movie would have been better in his hands?
Well, I mean, it couldn't have gotten worse.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
The thing about Del Toro is he is a very creative filmmaker, but he doesn't have, like, the track record of, like, Spielberg or even Michael Bay. Like, mm-hmm. his movies typically struggle to make money, which is fine. But that makes me think, though, you had the Mummy movie the Mummy movie they made struggle to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you look at these situations, it's like, well, what's the better bet, you know? Putting your film in the hands of a creative director who has like a signature style and perhaps doesn't have a great track record for making billions of dollars, and then you get at least something creative out of it,
mm-hmm.
or you know, having somebody like Alex Kurtzman make something so utterly generic, and then it bombs because people are like, blah, whatever.
The latter.
Yeah. I think with Del Toro too, that like what's so cool about his filmography is that, you know, he's been inspired by things, but he's done it's less recognizable. It's right. Like if he just did Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Hunchback of Notre Dame, he just did all these movies, same title, same premise, you know, I think that would be kind of a waste of his talent, even though he would bring a lot within those confines.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. Like when you look at like Pan's Labyrinth, that's not your typical monster film, right?
Yeah.
It's something he brought a lot more to it. So I'd hate to see him just confined just to that, although he seems to regret not being confined to that, not having that, being able to remake all his movies that have inspired him over the years, all right. The classic monster movies. But
and we kind of approached this when we talked about Rian Johnson a couple of weeks ago. Would we rather watch him, Rian Johnson, make a Star Wars trilogy, or rather watch three original Rian Johnson movies? And we both sided on the idea of like, we want to watch three original Rian Johnson movies just based on his other three movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think Del Toro is kind of the, there's the same thought about Del Toro, except he actually did that. He could have made The Hobbit. He was up for like the Justice League Dark, which is like all these supernatural combo characters, but he'd worked on that for a couple of years too. So it seems like he gets involved with these things under the idea of I love this world, I'm going to get to play with these people and these themes and in these settings, and then he, you know, kind of gets bored, either bored out of the long process it's taken, perhaps bored with how, you know, studio interference, you know, you can't, you know, maybe he couldn't have made his version of The Hobbit, you know, because mm-hmm. the studios were expecting something more in line with what Jackson did. And of course, that's what they got. And, you know, when was the last time you heard anybody talk about The Hobbit films?
Except Jackson didn't have as much time to work on those as Del Toro did.
Well, no, yeah, it was rushed, and then they added a third one.
Right.
There were issues all over the place with The Hobbit, but I do wonder how much of this is, in other words, I wonder if in 2007 he said yes, would we have like read a story in like 2009 and 2010 saying like Del Toro walks away from mm-hmm. Dark Universe because unspecified
or fired
issues.
Like so many of the Star Wars directors and stuff, right?
Yeah, you're right. That's the flip side of it too, is that you have studios who love to hire like these like visionary directors, these wonderful creative types, and then when they don't make something that fits in the generic theme of what they want to produce and in sort of the very mechanical cookie cutter way, not to say that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, you can't hire iconoclasts like Del Toro and then, you know, try to just restrain them in the studio system. You have to kind of work with him. because I do think he has that bone in his head where he maybe gets excited about being part of an established universe, but then he realizes, you know, I'd rather be Del Toro and do this story about the guy with eyes in his hands, or or like giant plant monsters in Hellboy 2 or what have you. Yeah. So, but he does have this wonderful way of humanizing the monsters, which I think is what the Mummy sorely lacked, because it wasn't about the Mummy. It was about Tom Cruise running away from the Mummy. And that's...
Yeah,
that's not how
amongst
you
other
get
things.
Down. Amongst other things. <Yeah. laughs> Like prodigium. Did you see the Mummy, by the way?
I didn't, and now I'm not going to see it. Yeah. I think
talked
I've
you
better,
out of it, huh?
Something better yes. to do with 90 minutes of my life or whatever, 100
strategy
minutes.
Strategy worked. Great. One less person.
I think it's more like 2 hours, actually.
2 hours? Wow. That's too bad.
Yeah.
You know what? Yeah. I mean, I think there were some good ideas in The Mummy. I just think it was poorly executed. I think, you know, rewatching Iron Man 1 recently, it's, you know, that's kind of where it all started with the shared universe thing. But if you go back and rewatch Iron Man 1, if you cut out the post-credit scene with Nick Fury, then and you change one of the characters who's like with S.H.I.E.L.D. and instead put him in, you know, the FBI or the CIA or something, it's the exact same movie. And I think that's where...
Oh, The Mummy's the exact same movie?
No, that Iron Man would be the exact same movie if you changed those two little things. You got rid of the Nick Fury cameo and you got rid of the S.H.I.E.L.D. references. Yeah. It would be the exact same movie. It would play out the exact same way. And I think that's where these franchise films screw up.
Isn't most of... Yeah, I was going to say, aren't most of those films like following the same sort of formula? The guy, the regular guy that gets entangled with the supernatural powers or something and then has to like that.
Right. But what I'm saying is, if you just treat it like if they didn't have this elaborate sequence where they take Tom Cruise to prodigium, you know, if it was just a Mummy movie, at the end you meet Jekyll and he's like, "Welcome to prodigium."
He's got like eyes in his hands.
That would have been a good touch.
That would have been that would have been dope. That would have been dope.
You got to bring it up to 2017, man. Like you can't stay back there.
Or maybe if, you know, clearly Del Toro likes fish monsters, you know, we got Shape of Water, you got Ape Sapien and Hellboy. So, you know, clearly you could have had the creature from the Black Lagoon at the end. It's like, oh, you thought the Mummy was badass.
Yeah. Post-credit sequence there. And you said we were bad movie developers. Like, we started this with a Die Hard, a great Die Hard. And now we're doing the same right now.
So. And Rob Schneider should be in all these movies.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, Kevin James is Al Powell.
We need more brainstorming, actually.
Well, speaking of brainstorming, there was definitely some brainstorming in putting together this year's Sundance, which is the independent. If you don't know your sort of movie festivals, it's this independent, supposed to be independent festival in Utah, Park City, Utah, started by Robert Redford. It's really not, I mean, it's Hollywood kind of goes to Utah for a couple of weeks in January. So it's not really the indie scene it once perhaps started out as.
No, and actually, sorry to cut you off.
No, it's all right.
Martin McDonagh, a guy who we'll be talking about later, when he premiered his film, it actually opened Sundance 2008. Mm-hmm. And that was the comment that he had. He was like, this isn't really an independent festival. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's a lot of questionably large films here. You know what I mean? So... Mm-hmm. That's what it reminds me of. Yeah.
Yeah, and they talk about first time directors a lot.
Oh,
it's like Ethan Hawke, and you know,
Ethan Hawke's a first time director.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think so. I don't know. And like Paul Dano, it's like people who are connected are the first time directors.
Oh yeah.
At Sundance.
Yeah. Well, that's very true.
So just to elaborate on your point.
But, you know, it's hard to, despite that, it's hard to ignore that a lot of stuff came out of Sundance. From just last year, you had Big Sick, you had Get Out, you had Mudbound. Those were all out of Sundance. So, you know, we can't ignore this festival.
And then Whiplash, you know what I mean, in 2009.
Yeah.
Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, so we're going to look at some of the stuff coming out. I paid sort of particular attention to the documentaries. Because if you definitely detect the theme, because there's a documentary about Jane Fonda called Jade Fonda in Five Acts. There's a doc about Gloria Allred called Seeing Allred. There's a documentary about Joan Jett called Bad Reputation. And then there's a doc about Ruth Bader Ginsburg called RBG, which sounds a bit like RGB, which is of course the colored tuning and you know on and digital. I don't know what the two have to do with the other, but that's what I thought of. And then there's a documentary about Fred Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor? So it's you know, I'm thinking like you have all these docs about very powerful, influential women, and then you have Fred Rogers, who is the sort of the epitome of good, you know, good culture and good raising and, you know, manners and getting along and, you know, being cool and just, you know, everybody's, you know, stranger's a friend you haven't met, that kind of aesthetic. How many kids were raised on Mr. Rogers to be, you know, good people? So I'm wondering, it's like powerful women and being well-mannered. I wonder what this is in a response to.
Yeah, it could be. Like, when I looked at the documentaries, I saw a lot of themes, too, like on immigration,
yeah.
racial profiling, political corruption, environmental corruption. So there was probably a lot to do with harassment going on now, but might see even more next year because they're probably not that far ahead of the curve. So this year, mm-hmm. I was seeing a lot on sort of like Trump policies, basically immigration, racial profiling. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Not a huge surprise, I guess, for me, you know what I mean? After the whole Academy thing, it seems like that's they're gonna think twice about that now, all of these festivals and whatnot.
And I'm sure like a lot of this
now, even if you're affiliated with like, you know, the wrong person, you can't have that film in your festival. So it's all like,
well, I mean, I guess that was us again talking about how they erased Kevin Spacey from a movie that hadn't come out yet.
It was,
you know, that's very true. The response to that has been sort of sharp and immediate, at least in the Hollywood realm. I do wonder, though, because a lot of these allegations, particularly the harassment and assault allegations, you know, these would have been, a lot of these movies would have been selected long before. Or would have been received at least, or chosen, or in the ether anyway, with the various programmers long before that news came out. So I do wonder.
Really? You think?
Well, probably several months ago they started getting.
Oh, okay. Like my timelines are kind of funny. But it just seems like it's been a thing for a while now.
Well, I mean, in Trump-adjusted terms, it's, you know, it's been about 20 years, but it's,
well,
it's, you know, I think it was in October that the Weinstein thing broke.
Right, okay.
So, they, you know, Sundance would have been considering their movies long before that.
Right.
But, I mean, this is just the sort of like the general response to the general feeling. I wonder what the whiplash will be as we sort of go further along with not just the film festivals, as you were saying. Or, you know, the Academy Awards, which has in the past been attacked for not being representative at all.
The Academy Awards could get really awkward this year. I wonder, they haven't announced a host yet, have they?
Kimmel's back.
Oh, Jimmy Kimmel?
Yeah.
Could get really awkward. They were even talking about canceling them, and then they said no because they love to celebrate themselves, right? So they're not going to cancel the Oscars.
No, but, it's...
And then it would be bad for people who've had great performances, too, to not have it that year, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's... I mean, certain people will find that night of the year suddenly very free for them. Yeah. But, you know, I think Harvey Weinstein was a dependable attendee, no matter if there was a Miramax or a Weinstein Company film, and Kevin Spacey too, for that matter. But yeah, it's there's definitely going to be some notable absences. Mm-hmm. Back to Sundance, though. You know, say what you want about Ethan Hawke, but you know, this movie he did, the Blaze, which is about like a little known Texas musician. I mean, it's not like he went out and made, you know, Before Sunset 4 or something like that. It's, you know, he shows himself stretching. You know, we did Maudie earlier this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about stretching. That was a very un-Ethan Hawke-like performance from him. So, you know, he may get further ahead of the game than you or Vince as filmmakers during his first time movie to Sundance. But, you know, I think he's probably earned a shot, but...
Yeah, I jotted down Blaze. It looks like a really interesting movie. I like a lot of that outlaw country music. I haven't heard of the songwriter. I think there's other people they could do, like Waylon Jennings would be a good subject for a movie, but I'll digress on that because he had a really interesting life. But Ethan Hawke, yeah, but that's the thing, right? Like, but they announce on their website, like, first-time filmmakers, and then you look at it, and it's like...
47 first-time filmmakers.
So. They're all connected, right? They're all people who have... But it's cool that he's doing his passion project, and I think Bo Burnham's doing his passion project. He's got a movie, Eighth Grade.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like every time I see one of these, I don't know, someone who is not originally a director, okay, having a first film that's like a coming of age story about somebody struggling through high school, I like immediately, my heart just drops because I know it's going to be generic and it's going to be whatever, use whatever synonym you want for generic. It's going to be that.
Are you saying their high school experiences aren't unique?
I am.
Lady Bird's like getting the most buzz right now from Greta Gerwig, right?
Like, yeah, okay, fine. It's like...
I haven't seen it, though.
I'm obviously not saying all of them are, but it's like the good majority of them are.
Yeah.
And Bo Burnham's like, what, my age? He's like, you know what I mean? Like in his mid-20s, like... Or maybe older, I don't know. But I can't imagine he has anything too profound to say about that experience. So,
well, take that.
Needless to say.
Take that, Bo Burnham.
Bo Burnham. There's a lot of hate for Bo Burnham. Oh, that was on another show. There was hate because he's in the Big Sick.
I don't like – I'm not that.
I liked his old YouTube clips. I actually thought he was really funny back in the day. When he was like 15, I thought that was –
I didn't like
cool.
really know who he
that
was.
That old fogey Bo Burnham.
It's like
he's so played out at 25 or whatever. Anyway, that brings us to this piece of ephemera, this burnt out piece of ephemera. Let's play the clip.
In time, you will know what it's like to lose, to feel so desperately that you're right, yet to fail all the same. Dread it. Run from it. Destiny still arrives.
Evacuate the city. Engage all defenses. And get this man a shield.
And that was a clip from the trailer for Avengers Infinity War. That's the ultimate Marvel Studios movie that comes out next summer, marking actually the 10th year anniversary of Marvel Studios and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So I guess it's apropos that it looks like every Marvel character ever in a Marvel movie is there. What did you guys think of it?
I'm looking at Tim's notes and it just says cool with an exclamation mark.
You see, I have really in-depth notes for the other sections, yeah. But for that, I just wrote cool. Yeah, that's all I wrote.
Fair enough. It's
just Three Billboards, it looks like, has much more writing, but the good, Infinity War is, yeah.
Good. I'm glad. First of all, thank you for reading Tim's notes.
I'm sorry.
This is how he's getting most of his ideas, actually.
But, I mean, if we're going to put the emphasis on anything, I'm glad it was Three Billboards rather than Avengers. You know, I guess it's, for me, it's funny on a couple of levels. Having reviewed Justice League a couple of weeks ago, I'll get to that in a sec. But it's also funny to me watching a trailer because it seems like, for a couple of people, like I was primarily thinking of Scarlett Johansson because she's a natural blonde. She's blonde in the clip there. Chris Evans didn't have to shave his, you know, between Avengers movie beard. He was just able to show up in his Avengers post Avengers beard, and so you know, good for them. They didn't have to dress up too much. Again, coming off of Justice League, which one of my main complaints was the villain. Which was like a CGI blob monster and didn't have much personality. I was glad to see that the big purple dude who was doing the voiceover there, Thanos, played by Josh Brolin, it actually felt like Josh Brolin was behind the CGI blobbiness, which I appreciated. But
CGI blobbiness, that is, I love that. It's another one you can coin.
Excellent. I'm up to $1.85 of all these, coining all these phrases. And then one of the things that does concern me is, coming off of this year of comic book movies, the theme has seemed to be not going the typical route, because you have things like Logan, which was about like mortality and getting old and you know, facing your death and, you know, all that stuff. You had like Wonder Woman, first female superhero action movie directed by a woman, so, but just like a groundbreaker in those simple terms. You had Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which is just like James Gunning all over the place. And then you had Thor Ragnarok, which was very Taika Waititi. And then, so now we're going to be going back. And then between now and then, we have Black Panther, which is another sort of milestone moment, because you have a big action movie, black director, black superhero, predominantly black cast, almost entirely black cast, except for a couple of main actors. And then we're going to go back to the Avengers, where, you know, they're fighting more CGI monsters, and it's, you know, it's more characters than ever, and it's kind of directed by the, well, it's not kind of, it is directed by the Russos, who are talented directors, and I think have done a good job. They did the last two Captain America movies, but they're very journeyman directors. Like, I'm not expecting them to bring anything new to this. Their primary responsibility is to somehow balance the 137 different superheroes that are in this. Anyone else?
Cool. No, I saw the trailer again for Black Panther before Three Billboards, and I thought that looks really interesting because it's something different, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, like so much of this is sort of the same looking people in the same costumes,
yeah,
with slightly different superpowers, you know? It's just like, at least that might be a different universe, right? And it looked like it could be something really exciting and really, really be good, because there hadn't been like a black universe for superheroes before.
Yeah.
The only one movie I can think of is a really lame Eddie Murphy movie where he played a black superhero because there were none or something.
And it are was you really, thinking of Meteor Man?
Or was it? Was it Meteor Man? There was something and it was horrible. But at least with this, you know, with Black Panther, it could be something and something really good and something yeah. new and original.
Who is directing it?
Ryan Coogler.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. Big fan of his previous movies.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that I'm looking forward to. You know, Ms. Marvel, I'm looking, even Aquaman, because it's, you know, under the sea and it's, you know, it's
Little Jason. Mermaid.
the fight between Sebastian the Crab and Aquaman is going to be off the chain.
At least that would be different.
That would be different.
Yeah. I might be down for that. In 3D, even? Like, kidding me? Mm-hmm. Those pincers are like coming right at you. Like, that's,
they should fill the cinema up with water slowly. And
oh, yeah.
The D-box? Yeah.
Yeah, like one of those, what is it? A movie with Fred Astaire where the building is collapsing.
Right. Right. I can't remember the name.
I don't know.
Of
that. I'm digressing hard here, so.
Yeah. Well, let's digress into some music.
All right.
Let's set the stage, because I just took this right off the Three Billboards of Ebbing, Missouri soundtrack. It is the Buckskin Stallion Blues by Amy Enel. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Thank you.
match no one who's ever been arrested, and when the DNA don't match any other crime nationwide, and when there wasn't a single eyewitness from the time she left your house to the time we found her, well, right now, there ain't too much more we can do.
Could pull blood from every man and boy in this town over the age of 8.
There's civil rights laws prevents that, Mrs. Hayes. And what if he was just passing through town?
Pull blood from every man in the country, then.
And what if he was just passing through the country?
If it was me, I'd start up a database. Every male baby that's born, stick him on it. And as soon as he'd done something wrong, cross-reference it, make 100% certain it was a correct match, then kill him.
Yeah, well, there's definitely civil rights laws prevents that. I'm doing everything I can to track him down. I don't think those billboards is very fair.
The time it took you to get out here whining like a bitch, Willoughby, some other poor girl's probably out there being butchered right now. But I'm glad you got your priorities straight. I'll say that for you.
And that was a clip from Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. It is the new film from Martin McDonagh, and it stars Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, Peter Dinklage, Caleb Landry Jones, and John Hawkes.
Ebbing, Missouri, not a real town, by the way. It was mostly filmed in North Carolina. Fun fact.
Way to puncture that suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, no worries.
Now I don't believe in nothing no more. It frankly, it doesn't bother me. It wasn't really Missouri. I think the themes it deals with are kind of a bit bigger than...
Just throwing it out as a fact. It was segueing right into anything.
I was
anything.
Going on Expedia to look for cheap hotels.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Advertising agency and a police station right across the street. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to check that out.
But where was the Longos?
Yeah, exactly.
or the Starbucks, for that matter. This is a very interesting movie. It's funnier than I thought it would be given the subject matter, but it's also more serious as the sort of the deeper you go into it, go into the story. You know, it sort of gets into your head more. Just, you know, the emotionality of it, because the story is about this woman, Mildred, whose daughter was killed some months before the start of the movie, rather brutally killed and assaulted. And she's frustrated because there has been no arrest. And so she takes these three billboards on an old road, rents them, and basically harasses the police chief about why he has not solved her daughter's murder. Although that's really not what the movie is entirely about. It goes into some very curious directions that we will try not to spoil, because I think we do not want to spoil some of the key. Although if you've seen a Martin McDonagh film, you know there's kind of a twist with some of the characters.
This would be an easy movie to spoil. Deep into the plot of
Well, Martin McDonagh is a very interesting person, actually. A very interesting artist. I started in community theater, and on the playbills of my two shows, it said that the biggest influence creatively for me was Martin McDonagh. I was probably about 18 at that time, so I followed his work like quite a bit. And as much as he started in theater, and he represents to me a certain character like Steven Soderbergh or Tarantino that just kind of made it through sheer like grit and talent.
Mm-hmm.
He started in theater, even though his first love was cinema, but he didn't have access to it really. So it's interesting to see Martin McDonagh at this kind of status, winning the People's Choice Award, a TIFF and stuff like that. And as much as he kind of shuns theater a bit, I think there's an undeniably theatrical kind of quality to all of his movies. You know, In Bruges feels like, you know, just by virtue of the fact that it's two guys and it's this kind of contained town, it feels almost theatrical in that sense. Seven Psychopaths, which was like arguably, you know, the most cinematic and the biggest, I felt, was his weakest work.
Yeah.
And even his first short film, Six Shooter, which was set entirely on a train, was very kind of theatrical. So this movie, for me, felt like it was finally kind of striking that balance between a theatrical, it's set, again, in kind of a small town, where there's kind of an intimate cast of characters, and a big kind of cinematic movie. So I think Martin McDonagh is growing as a filmmaker in that sense as well.
You're making an interesting point, because I think both Ebbing in this movie and Bruges feel like very staged places.
Yes, yeah.
That have sort of character on their own, and you're kind of missing that in Seven Psychopaths, because it's jumping around from place to place, and so much of it in the middle of the desert.
The kind of chronology stuff is not stuff that you're really able to do in theater the way you are in cinema. So again, it's him, I think, kind of adjusting to the new art form. But this time I found that I didn't, like, Martin McDonagh was not really the reason why I really enjoyed this film like I did with all of his other films. Like, it was really the writing and kind of the rich dialogue of Bruges that I really liked. I have to say, like, Frances McDormand was, like, one of the reasons, the big reasons for me why I enjoyed this. I think she carries this movie big time.
She's really, really good.
And the performances that he's able to get out of his actors might come from, you know, his status in theater. They really respect Martin McDonagh in the theatrical world.
Yeah.
And I thought Sam Rockwell is an amazing performance.
He was the, like, hidden gem in this film.
Yeah, it's really good. There's so much moral ambiguity. There's so much ambiguity in the movie in general when you look at the plot. And how it evolves. But a lot of moral ambiguity, too, because Frances McDormand's character, definitely not the most likable character. She's not like what you'd see in other movies. Like, my daughter's been murdered.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tearing myself apart here. She was very, you know, very direct, very, she had like a trucker mouth on her kind of thing. And so it's very interesting to see that character who would, in most circumstances, not be very likable, but you're feeling some empathy given her circumstances, basically.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a moment where you see her in sort of the typical mourning emotions, typical grieving emotions. There's no sadness. Mm-hmm. There's no depression. And perhaps Mildred had those at some point. But at this point, we see her in the film. The other smart thing is that there's like one kind of singular flashback to, I guess it was the last time she saw her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a bit problematic because the daughter literally walks out the door because they're having an argument about whether she can take the car, and she's like, fine, I'm gonna walk, and I hope I do get raped. And of course, that's how she meets her fate. Mm-hmm. That there's something kind of cinematic, like just like kind of movie writing about that, but since it's only kind of dealt with the once, you kind of let it slide, and because you're just kind of dealing with her raw anger the whole time and her frustration, because what can she do? She's, you know, the victim's mother. She's not the police. She's not a private eye. She's not Sherlock Holmes. So what can she do other than, you know, sit on these police? And it doesn't make sense, and it's not irrational, because of course the police want to catch, you know, someone who's brutalized someone in their own community. And you can, that's the great thing about this film, is like there's really kind of no villains. I mean, there's at certain points of the film, you have people acting villainously towards each other, but these are not bad people per se.
Yeah,
and that definitely comes through the police chief, because I think in the hands of a different screenwriter, there would have been a tendency to have a good guy and a bad guy. But I would argue that there's no bad guys, but I also argue there's no good guys either. There's just these people struggling with life.
Sort of moral ambiguity of the whole thing.
Yeah,
and you would say there might be some characters who come across like really bad at the start, and then as it progresses, you're actually cheering for them. So it's a very interesting way all these characters evolve throughout, and you're not really sure, like, you know, what's their angle, and it's very interesting. And
I do have a couple of issues with the film, though. One of them is what you're talking about, though. Like, we're talking about some of the ambiguity of the characters in a positive way. I think the ambiguity of Sam Rockwell's character wasn't earned, really. The transition from what he is at the start to what he becomes, I don't feel was very smooth and not really that earned, as I say. The other thing is, I really don't like the trope of people dying and then they write letters and then it's like, oh, they're living on after they've died through the letters. Mm-hmm. And that's done to like full effect in this film. And it feels just a little bit phony and kind of, especially like the tone of the letters and who writes them. It just feels kind of like off. And it's hard not to see this film like, knowing what I know about McDonough and how he writes, which is not kind of planning out his stories. He just kind of starts writing and then, you know, sort of like the Coen brothers do. It just unfolds as he's writing. Right. So I think he trapped himself in some story plot holes in that sense as well.
Yeah.
There are a couple of scenes I feel towards, you know, the middle and the end. That feel kind of thrown in there. Like he didn't know where he was going with the story. So they just kind of abruptly appeared. Which is why I say that Frances McDormand for me was the big appeal, because there are a lot of narrative hiccups I feel in this.
When that character dies, I do feel like the story takes a turn.
Yes.
And I will also add that that character seemed oddly loquacious in the hours before.
Yes.
He
and
dies.
Would that character's wife, like, you know, after discovering that her husband just did that, go around delivering letters around town?
A mailman. Yeah.
I'm not sure.
It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
But,
it's a bit
odd. Okay. Those things I can kind of forgive.
There's a lot of suspension of disbelief in this.
It's just like
people are committing, like, felonies left, right, and center. They're still out walking around, you know? So that's the one thing, too.
Yeah.
Right?
That being said, it's like a really funny movie. It is.
Yeah.
Both Martin McDonagh and his brother, John Michael McDonagh, are filmmakers, and they both, I feel, recycle something, which is like poking fun at stupid people. Okay.
Yeah.
Especially in The Guard, it's like they're really good at writing stupid people and then having like intellectually superior people like bash the stupid people, which Sam Rockwell kind of is in this. He's like the punching bag,
and
stupid
his mother, too.
Just for the sake of being stupid. And it's like, okay,
I'm actually not sure about that, because in that clip you have, you know, Woody Harrelson as a police chief, like talking about like, well, that just violates all the civil laws. So it's civil rights. So it's like, it almost like he really doesn't understand the law, because, you know, my limited knowledge of American law is that, you know, that, you know, you're skirting, it's not just civil rights, it's also you're skirting pretty close to, like, you know, Fifth Amendment issues about self-incrimination when you're talking about creating databases purely for the purpose of profiling people who might commit a crime. But having said that, I'm not sure I feel the characters are stupid.
I think specifically, like, one or two of them are made to be, like, punching bags, basically. Like, their stupidity never becomes anything
bags, but I think it's inferred that Sam Rockwell's character, Dixon, kind of brings it on himself.
Yeah, I'm just saying both Martin McDonagh and his brother, like, use that a lot. And it's used again in this film. So, like, I think it's used a lot less in Bruges, I think. But, you know, even in his, like, stage plays. But all I'm saying is that I think that's something that for his next project, I think he could, like, tone down a bit.
Set it at Oxford. But yeah, it's I find about him as interesting is the way he can, like, humanize despicable people. In Bruges, you're talking about the main character, the two main characters are both, you know, contract killers, and the Colin Farrell character is on the run because he accidentally killed a kid in the commission of doing a hit. So, you know, from the get-go, you're dealing with, like, despicable people. And it's like, it doesn't matter that Colin Farrell killed a kid by accident. He's still a hitman. But at the same time, you're kind of rooting for him. And I think this is where McDonagh's really good is sort of humanizing. Mm-hmm. Speaking of humanizing monsters from early in the show, humanizing these, like, incredibly frail, incredibly dark, you know, human people. It's at once the best of humanity and the most disgusting of humanity. And it's quite the trick, because usually when you watch these movies, the Ralph Fiennes character in Bruges is a bloody monster. He's swearing every other word. Every other word is F this. He's clearly.
But he does have like a small moral code that makes him somewhat likable, though. Like,
he has a small moral code.
Has no tolerance for like accidentally doing what he did. Yeah.
Yes.
and again, those are just a few small gripes. I think people should see this movie. Like, it's a very good, very funny movie.
Yes. And
it's funny. Awesome. And dark, and it makes you think too.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, some of the characters, like the mother and Sam Rockwell, you're meant to like, I think, like, I agree with you that you're meant to sort of look above and down on them, but that's where the humor comes from.
Right. They're very hicky. Yeah.
They're hick. They're like, you know, small town, southern or Midwestern U.S., small town hicks kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, their logic, they go about, their logic, like the mother when he's fired, is like, oh, can't you get a couple thousand from them? You worked there a few years. And then, like, it's kind of like... it's
not
like
to mention the 6 years you spent in the academy.
Yeah, exactly.
Plus the one they held you back for.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like there's a logic there to it, right?
Yeah,
which is
interesting. Yeah. And there is like a backstory that he creates for like everybody kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like that gives it that depth. It's like, you know, like he did, you know, flunk out of a year of like police school. And there's also a great performance by John Hawks, who is the ex-husband.
Yeah.
And he's dating this kind of very young,
questionably
young woman.
I made a note of that actress, Samara Weaver, because that could have been a nothing burger. But she, in like the two scenes she's in, she has such great comedic timing.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is amazing. And I hope she gets a lot of work after this, because that, again, that could have been just like, the stereotypical, you know, middle-aged man going out with a woman half his age, breaking up with his wife. But, you know, she just pops in and offers these little pearls of wisdom at just the right time. It's quite funny, and it's quite charming in its way.
It does lead somewhere. There is the scene where she, where Frances McDormand and John Hawks and that woman finally come to a head. It actually does.
While she's on a date with Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
Peter Dinklage, yeah.
There is actually a very kind of moving, resolution to all of that, I guess.
That's another thing about Martin McDonagh, because there was a what was the actor's name? Jordan Prentice, who's in Bruges, who's also a little person. So clearly there's something there with Martin McDonagh and little people. I'm not
there
sure.
There are a lot of recurring stuff like suicide. There's a lot of suicide in his work as well. And, you know, without spoiling too much, it is featured in this film.
Yeah.
So there are obviously topics, or there are images that he knows will evoke an emotional reaction out of people.
Yeah.
That and he loves to use.
Yeah. We got a Clark Peters appearance.
It's actually funny. In one of his plays, a character says, you can't have a comma in the title of your work. And here's Martin McDonagh with a comma in the title of his movie. So.
Well, rules are made to be broken.
Exactly.
But I would agree with you that I think this is... I would have to see, this is kind of still recently in my memory, so I'd have to see it a couple more times. But I think it's between In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. Seven Psychopaths took me a couple of viewings for me to like it, because it's sort of straight.
Meta.
Yeah, it was very meta, although it does have my favorite mid-credit scene of all time with Tom Waits calling Colin Farrell. I'm going to come by on Tuesday and kill you. Yeah, Tuesday works pretty good. It's so funny. But I like it a lot, and I think you're right about it. It's not necessarily about McDonagh. It's about Frances McDormand. It's about, and I would even say it's about Woody Harrelson. This has been a great year for Woody Harrelson.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen LBJ, but I think that he's going to get some kind of awards love at the end of this, and I think it's either going to be for this, maybe Outside Chance, Planet of the Apes, but
I
don't think Woody Harrelson for this. I don't think he'll get
it. I think it'll be Sam Rockwell. Yeah, and Frances McDormand will 100% get nominated.
Yes, she
don't
will.
Put your money on anything else.
Yes, yeah. No, she will definitely get nominated, and I would go so far as to say that, you know, Martin McDonagh is probably another lock for at least screenplay.
Do you think? Yeah. I don't know.
But
I mean,
for screenplay, probably.
Because this is an original screenplay.
It is.
The contenders, you know, I think at this point it's between McDonough and Tarantino for screenplay Oscars.
This happens every year, though, where I'm like, oh, that definitely will not get nominated for this, that, or the other thing, and then mm-hmm. it does. So I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about, I guess, is what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens. You never know what it might. But I think we have Golden Globe noms next week.
Shortly. Oh, okay.
So that'll be an indication. Not that it's all about the awards.
What category will this go in? Golden Globes will be
great.
Comedy.
Considering it's gonna Get Out is comedy.
It's gonna make the Hollywood Foreign Press explode.
Their heads are gonna explode.
Well, I think there was a lot of news about Get Out being a comedy.
Oh, really?
They were putting Get Out in comedy. Which, I mean, there are some...
They just roll dice, and then whatever it lands on category it goes in.
You know what? I think for the Hollywood Foreign Press, it's all about cramming as many stars into the room as humanly possible. Yep. it's really not that complicated. I think people are always trying to outthink the Hollywood Foreign Press, and I don't think it's like... they don't think.
Well said.
I was kind of reading... online reaction to this, and maybe you guys have some insight, but there are a lot of people who were kind of, I guess they felt they weren't satisfied by the ending because, you know, not much changes in the end. I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the central crime that kicks everything off is solved. I mean, that would be too pat. I think, you know, this isn't Law and Order or CSI or one of those, right? But I think people are kind of vaguely dissatisfied because the end, going back to that moral ambiguity, it ends with two of the characters sort of driving off, likely to make a very bad decision, but not entirely sure they want to make that decision.
Right. Yeah.
And I think people see that as a letdown, but are dismissing the human nature of it, of just how tough it is for people to change.
I think the ending is intellectually satisfying, but it's not viscerally satisfying.
Well, no.
Like, you can, like, when you're watching you start thinking, okay, what could happen here? So you're thinking about it, what could happen, but you're not seeing it. So people are so used to seeing on the screen everything, right?
Yeah.
So to leave it open-ended, that can really discourage a lot of audiences who are used to seeing, you know, in the Cineplex something with a beginning, middle, and definitive end kind of thing, right?
Right. So, yeah. I get that, and I wonder that. I mean, I think people sort of going back to the Christmas show last week and talking about Christmas Carol, and, you know, you get visited by ghosts, and automatically you do a complete 180 on everything you've come to understand and know about life, and life isn't really like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you make changes, they are small changes. They are small moves. But, you know, your life doesn't turn around like that. And I think that's where the Sam Rockwell arc, as you were saying, kind of falls flat, because there is kind of that turnaround for him. And it does, you know, feel like reading one letter all of a sudden he's an entirely different person. And that kind of feels – that part of it kind of feels – wrong in where the rest of the story is going. And I think that's kind of where McDonough hits a speed bump, is if you follow the movie, the track the movie is on, the ending makes sense, but sort of where he takes the Rockwell character doesn't necessarily in keeping with the rest of that. So, you know, if that was a bit different, if, you know, maybe if there was like a small change in Rockwell's character, if he didn't suddenly become kind of like Super Cop or recast himself as Super Cop in the end, That might have made the difference, I think.
Have you seen, I was thinking about Nocturnal Animals. Have you seen that movie?
I have not seen that yet, although I have it on demand.
I'm wondering, he probably developed a script before that, given his process and his history, but there's quite a few similarities with that, and with the sort of, it's not like a Midwestern, but a Texas police officer and saying, I'm going to just go and get this guy, and just quite a few similarities. And there's Jake Gyllenhaal's wife and daughter are raped. You don't see it, but it's a pivotal plot point. I think there's quite a few similarities between this and that. Nocturnal Animals was a lot darker. There wasn't a lot of comedy. However, when the Texas cop came in, like the "I'm gonna get this guy no matter what," you laughed because the guy was just so over the top. Like, "I'm gonna get this guy no matter what. I don't care. I don't have much time. He had cancer too. This cop, you know." So I'm wondering if
I'm intrigued now. I might go and watch that now.
Was it cool with an exclamation mark though? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, actually, that one was cool with about 7. Yeah, I actually enjoyed that movie more than the.
If
more
it doesn't pass billboards. The 10 exclamation mark point, then I want nothing to do with it. I'm sorry.
It gets Tim's lowest rating at 7 exclamation points.
No, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. So, I might check that out now. Yeah. But I was not expecting us to go to the Nocturnal Animals route, but there you have it. And there you have our edition of End Credits here. We hope you liked it, and if you did like it, check us out at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also download this and other episodes of the show via the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can go to Stitcher, Google Play, or iTunes, of course. You can find us on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, on Twitter at End Credits Radio. Tim, where can people find you on the internet in the weeks to come?
just won the Fringe Lottery, so I'm looking forward to putting on a Fringe play in Toronto
cool.
in July, so that's going to take up a lot of my time. And I just finished a short film called Cost of Living, which is really cool. It's in black and white, first thing I've done in black and white, so happy with that as well.
Well, congratulations on Fringe, that's a huge deal.
Thank you.
Vince.
Yes.
What have you been winning lately?
I actually just won the lottery, so I'm looking forward to going to Fiji and just, not coming back. So. No, you can find me on Facebook, Vincent Masson.
Oh, so you're not going to Fiji is the message.
No, that was a complete and total lie.
Understood.
Anybody who works with me who is listening to this, I'm not leaving.
Do you know Vince is going to Fiji? Anyway, here's some more not fake news. I will be back here later today for Open Source Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. That's news and politics at 5 p.m. on Thursday. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Anime Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. We will be back here same time, same channel on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, Thursday at 10 a.m. More End Credits for you, and we will see you then.